Hello and welcome to Chasing Chalamet, a podcast where I, Dane McDonald, recovering pop culture junkie, and Timothy Chalamet, aholic. And in this episode, some special guests, plural, are going to deep dive into the filmography and work of the one, the only, the Muad'Dib, the Laissa Al Ghul. Laissa Al Ghul. I'm already mixing up my franchises. That's Ra's al Ghul. Blanket statement for this episode. I'm going to mispronounce names. I'm going to mispronounce titles. I know that he's...
I'm not even going to try.
Yeah, I'm going to screw all that stuff up. So we're just getting that up off the top. Hopefully, maybe one or more of my guests will be more tuned into the Duneverse than I will.
I bet Emily will be.
And that's why we bring these experts on, because they're going to know these things. I come to cover the Timothy of it all, and then I bring experts on to talk about the individual films that he's in. But today, as you can tell, we're going to be talking about Denis Villeneuve's science fiction epic Dune Part 2. We're going to be covering our thoughts, our feelings, any critiques we may have, anything that we want or need to say about this latest entry in Timmy's filmography. And then together, we're going to discuss his performance and his role. What function does this character serve the story? In this case, spoiler, it's a pretty big part of the story. Is he cast well? What does his participation in this film bring to the table? And then on a scale from 1 to 5 peaches, we're going to together grade the episode in different categories. We're going to together grade the movie in different categories.
I'm gonna grade the episode.
Yeah,
perfect.
That's what I'm perfect. Gonna do.
Emily yeah. already got 5 peaches, by the way.
My hair got 7.
Oh, there you go. I love we're going beyond 5. We're going to be grading the quality of the movie, his performance, his attractiveness, and most importantly, the reason I started this podcast, the reason I'm here. I'm not going to speak for our guests today, but I'm here for Timothée Chalamet's hair. Now that we've gotten all that stuff out of the way, I'm so excited to introduce today's guests. They are both prolific writers. They are podcast hosts collectively. They host the show Podcast Like It's in its current iteration as Podcast Like It's 1992. Please welcome Philip Iskov and Emily St. James. Hello, you guys.
It's all about Emily.
Hi.
It's all about for you.
Yeah.
I've just met Hello. Emily just now on the Google Meet, but I can already tell based on what you've said, Phil, Emily is the Dune expert here, and we are going to be relying on her for all of the Dune tidbits.
Oh, boy. That's fun. That's good.
How many of the Dune books have you read, Emily, out of curiosity?
0.
Oh. Really? Okay.
I have no knowledge of Dune.
Okay.
I walk into a Dune movie and I'm like, every scene, I'm like, who the fuck are these guys? And then I'm like, they seem fun. I'm so happy to be
well,
here.
Well, okay. Here, perhaps I know slightly more about Dune as a franchise than Emily does, but I will be terrible at pronouncing the names as well, Dane, so I'm not even going to attempt it, really.
Okay.
But, you know, for what that's worth. Other than Paul and Jessica, whose names are obviously
right.
totally normal.
Very, very easy.
Yeah.
This movie needed some Duncan Idaho, because I could also pronounce his name.
A great name.
Duncan Idaho. Gurney is getting like a little like, okay, I can. That's a word I know in English.
Sure.
As soon as we try to get to me pronouncing Austin Butler's character's name, I'm already feeling like I've said something wrong.
Yeah.
Politically incorrect.
I just call him Fade, and it just makes everything a lot easier.
That does work. Yeah. I've just gotten down Harkonnen, Arrakis.
Yes.
Atreides, sure. Yeah, like these mm-hmm. I can go toward, yeah. It has been a kind of collective joke on the internet that like people this far into the future are named like Paul and Jessica, but shout out to Frank Herbert for making that easy for us to pronounce.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, absolutely. Now, I have one question.
Yes.
Before we start. Who does Timothée Chalamet play in this movie? Because I wasn't entirely clear.
I think he's Paul Atreides. Pretty sure he's Paul.
Paul? Oh shit! Really?
But he is also what is the guy? What's the thing? What's his title?
There's Muad'Dib, which I believe Muad'Dib. Is the word for the little cute desert rat that makes its own moisture.
Yes. He's the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yes,
Haderach.
That's the one.
Which is the like? I just like saying that. I like to say that my baby is the Kwisatz Haderach. Although you should not wish that on your baby.
And Rebecca Ferguson's character is Lady Jessica. She's the Bene Gesserit.
The Bene Gesserit. Yes.
She's a part of the Bene Gesserit. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Here's what I know about Dune. I spent all of Saturday reading Wikipedia facts about Dune and bothering my wife with them. So that was what I did.
So do you know what's coming? Because like I learned about the human sandworms that are coming.
So yes. Okay. So Denis says he wants to make the second book into a third film, and then he's out.
Yeah.
But I assume that all these movies are going to continue making money.
Maybe.
But like both Denis and Timothy, mm-hmm. who, to be clear, I primarily know from his arc on Homeland, and I am so mad that there is not a Homeland episode of this
show.
There
might be. Give it time.
I will come in and do that.
Perfect.
Homeland from the Showtime Television Network, my favorite TV network.
Season two. He was there.
Yeah.
Emily does not have a vested interest in Showtime's success, just FYI.
I don't. No. I just like them for unrelated reasons.
But here's the thing. I agree with what you just said, Emily, which is that it seems as though Denis has made it clear he wants to do Messiah. He wants to do Messiah, and he wants to be done. He's like, I'm going to do like this three-film arc of Paul Atreides and his, let's be real, downward spiral, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the deeper you get into the series, the less filmable they become.
Yes.
Oh, there's a wonderful article on Defector that is called it's Frank Herbert's six Dune books ranked in order of filmability.
Sure.
They go from least filmable to most filmable, and the most filmable is Dune, and it's like, of course, they've done it twice already, and then it just keeps getting wilder. Yeah. But yes, book three involves like Paul's son. Spoilers, he has a son.
Yeah. Children of Dune?
Genetically?
Children of Dune. Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
He genetically like meshes himself with a sandworm.
Yeah.
Well, no, so that the spice makes him live forever. Because this is the thing. Hmm. Spice has this effect on you where like you can live forever. And then most people are like, they're done at a certain point. Like, I guess it's like a few hundred years. And they're like, I don't need to do this anymore. And they basically just die off. But this guy doesn't want to die. And then because of him ingesting so much spice, he turns into a sandworm.
Great. Cool.
I love it.
Emily's in.
Listen, I genuinely like, I like how... Apparently there's one of these books that's just people having conversations that don't really matter. That sounds great.
Right up your alley. You love shit like that, Emily. You love a tertiary sort of like something on the periphery that really doesn't have anything to do with anything, but people are doing deep dives into it.
I like in my day job, people will be like, okay, let's pitch a like riveting scene full of tension. And I'll be like, what if there was like a custody dispute? That is not an actual example, but that's like where my brain goes. I'm like, what's a small scale
here? There are six Dune books. Okay, there's Dune, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, Chapter House Dune, which is my favorite.
Chapter House Dune, great title.
Great title. Yeah. And then a short story he wrote called The Road to Dune, which I'm curious, but you know.
And like his son and some other people wrote like two dozen other Dune books.
Yeah, like, it's like a farm franchise now at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Now the family's like, it's the family business.
If you go on some and you're like, let's look at the Dune books in chronology. Yeah. Dune, the basis of the films Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2 and David Lynch's Dune is like book 20.
It does make me wonder, Dane, in terms of like, because obviously this is a podcast about Timothy Chalamet. When it was announced that he was going to be playing Paul Atreides, what were your feelings about that? I mean, what did that mean to you?
Great question. Originally, Denis' Dune was going to come out 2020, which means they must have filmed it 2019. So Timmy was probably cast like 2018. So we're like right in the kind of post like Call Me By Your Name, Beautiful Boy kind of landscape. So at that point, I was just excited that he was working.
Sure.
I never read a Dune book. The thing I had known probably most is that there was this David Lynch version, which sort of was like a cult classic in the sense that I knew some people loved it, but I also heard it was just like total trash. I struggle with Lynch in general, and this sounds like a movie that Lynch himself struggles with. So I was just kind of like four steps away from maybe not loving his Dune. So I was just excited he was working. I was more excited because I love Denis Villeneuve. I love his whole aesthetic. I think he's most, if not all, of his movies are great. So I was just excited for a director of his caliber to kind of get to play in that sandbox. But kind of sounds like similar to you guys. The extent of my Dune knowledge was like Wikipedia hopping. And I was just reading about like dudes who became sandworms. And I was like, if we're going to trust someone, I guess it's Denis.
Which, to be honest, fucking rips. Like, that's a great idea.
Have you seen the drawings of it, Emily? They're fucking crazy.
Yes, I have.
One of the covers is just like a sandworm, but with a face. Yeah. So, I mean, the AMC popcorn bucket for that is just going to be amazing.
It's going to be off the charts. I won't speak for you, Emily, but I'll just say from my perspective, obviously, you know, Timothée Chalamet had been very sort of open about the fact that he asked fucking Leonardo DiCaprio what his like career advice was to him. And he was like, don't do franchises, like don't do superhero comic movies, whatever.
Yes.
So when he signed on to do this, I was like, this is kind of the perfect one to do, right? Like it's very sort of esoteric and kind of strange, and it's its own thing. And it has this kind of patina of premium kind of high watermark of like art and, you know, whatever. And it seemed unfilmable and all these things that were kind of attached to it. And for him to take the lead role in that, I was like, well, this makes sense. Like, if he's going to do something of this enormity, like, this is the thing to do. That being said, I knew very little about Dune. And my association with Paul Atreides is Kyle MacLachlan, who...
Mm-hmm.
Was he around the same age, Emily, that Timothée Chalamet is now when he did Dune? Or was he a little older?
I think he was around the same age. Okay. The thing about Kyle MacLachlan is he seems like he's been 45 yeah. for like 50 years. Yeah. But I think he was right around the same age. Yeah. I'm a huge Lynch head, Lynch fan, Lynch stan. Dune, I really struggle with. It's not a very good movie. Yeah. It's easily the worst Lynch film.
Yeah.
And David Lynch would probably tell you that himself, but yeah.
He'd take his name off of it if he could. I mean, he's been pretty... The funny thing, too, is that with these Dunes, the new ones coming out and being so successful, there's now this whole, like, online desire to, like, put out the special edition of David Lynch's Dune, the long one with all the cut stuff, and, like, how do we get, you know... But, like, Lynch has no interest in doing it. It's like Fincher with Alien 3. It's like, it's dead to him. I mean, it's no interest.
Yeah, and I think... I get it. I think it's fine. Like, I don't know that... Obviously, there was a 3-hour cut that supposedly was better, but like seeing the two Villeneuve films and being like, you kind of need 6 hours to tell this story and you still feel like you're missing some of it is like, you know, it's just like Frank Herbert was writing in a tradition where you published a little bit of your book in a magazine. And like you had to keep people reading. Yeah. So it would just be like, and now there's a guy and he's bald and he can kill anybody. And he's the main villain. And you're like, we're like 500 pages into this, Frank. And he's like, no, trust me, it's going to work out.
It's going to be anyway, great. You're going to love it.
Anyway, I know it's a Chalamet podcast, but that fucking guy, hot as hell, Austin Butler, wreck me, daddy.
Emily, I was going to say, you know, I think that the way that this Dune is being made harkens to what you were discussing with Frank Herbert's kind of serialized now there's this bald dude and he's hot as hell, like that works in movies because it's like, oh shit, now we got to make part two, who's the hot guy we're gonna cast. And it was like Butler coming fresh off his Oscar nom for Elvis, which, you know, we don't need to get into the Elvis of it all. I thought that for, you know, all the highs and lows of that movie, I thought Austin Butler was pretty great, so the casting there really excited me. That being said, that guy's a little freak in this movie. I mean, that was just insane.
And the thing is, I was way more attracted to him as a little freak than I was as Elvis. Because Elvis, I'm supposed to find attractive. But you know who I want to sleep with? A little fucking freak. That's what I want.
A little bald freak.
See, who wants to kill people?
The smirk that he gives when Lady Margot... Margot, another easy name to pronounce in this universe. Less easy than the actress who plays her, Lea Seydoux. When she asks him to put his hand in the box and he smiles like it's the fucking kinkiest thing that's ever happened, I was like, hell fucking yeah. Like, this fucker. Yeah,
that part, actually, it's interesting because, like, so the whole black and white portion of this film, which was, like, shot in infrared, which is insane, but, like, generally speaking, when you shoot in black and white, you actually shoot in color and you turn it into black and white later so that the studio has the option if they decide that they do want to use color prints or whatever, right? Whereas with infrared, you don't have that option. It was like it had to be black and white. And that risk, it looked incredible, by the way. I loved the way that it kind of had this sort of like everything looked like stone. But when Margot takes him into her room that looks like something straight out of a Cronenberg movie, It's just like, fuck yeah, this is amazing.
Now that I think about it, women asking a man to put their hand in a box that will bring them immense pain is the queerest shit imaginable. But you can't pull your hand out or she'll kill you.
Dune 2 fall on your queerphobia scale, Emily?
Oh, simultaneously, negative 10 and 10.
It's yes, just,
it's everything.
The duality. No. The duality. Yeah.
Another thing I think is smart about this from Chalamet's career perspective is... the third movie, assuming it gets made, which it almost certainly will, they have to wait a while, you know? Yeah. Because there's a major character in that movie played by Anya Taylor-Joy who appears in one tiny bit of this movie. Most of this movie, she's an unborn baby. So we have to get to a place where we believe an unborn baby is now Anya Taylor-Joy. It's like, and also, you know, like the third book is Paul has been emperor for a while. All this stuff has been happening for a while. He has kids who are growing up. Like he doesn't have kids who are growing up, but he's like in the process of trying to get an heir, all this stuff. And so it's very much like you do need to get to a point where you need to be able to buy Chalamet as like a fun dad. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
So
I will be shocked if this third movie isn't out in less than 5 years. I mean, it seems like that.
I read a thing where Villeneuve was like, he wants to wait a while to do a time jump.
I think he also wants to make another movie in between.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He needs a break.
Yeah.
I think it'll be out in the early 2030s. I think it's going to be a bit.
Interesting.
It's going to be a sec. Yeah. Because I love Chalamet. I think you need to make him feel a little bit grizzled and he's not there yet. You know?
But this is a bigger question, though, Dane, in terms of, I'm sure this is something you're digging into with your show.
Yeah.
Or podcast is... he's a boy, right? Like he still is a boy. And I think that similar to like a DiCaprio, which took a while for us to start to see him as a man, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, I think that the film that probably is the bridge is probably like Departed, Shutter Island, Inception. Like that's where it's sort of happening for him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be, because Timothy he's very slender. Yes. He's very boyish.
Phil, you can say twink. I give you permission.
I appreciate that. He is very, yes, he has a twink vibe. And there's also kind of this, he's very beautiful. Like there's just, I think all of these things are going to your point, Emily, like can he grow a beard? Can he grow facial hair at this point? Like, I'm just not even convinced he can.
I think the smart thing Leo did, and I want to be clear.
Yes.
Leonardo DiCaprio's career is such a template for what Chalamet's doing that my personal trainer, a man who knows nothing about film discourse but sees everything, was like, I think that Timmy Shams, he said, is is finally going to be a movie star like Leo. And I was like, how do you know this? It's just like it's filtered into you somehow. Anyway, I think the thing that Leo did that was smart was he did The Aviator. Which is like a movie that lets him start as the fresh-faced boy and age up to the fucking the guy who's like living in a shoebox. And like, I think that I hate the womb to tomb biopic. I think it's a format that's very hard to do well. I think Chalamet just needs to sign on to one and just be like, right now I'm 16 and right now I'm 56.
Isn't that what he's doing right now? Isn't the Bob Dylan thing?
I was going to say, he's about to start production on the Bob Dylan biopic.
Well, listen, I know nothing about Timothy Chalamet, so that's except that he was in Homeland Season 2.
I love that you guys bring this up because I'm in complete agreement with you guys, and I think contextually within his career, this is such an interesting movie. It's his first sequel, which, you know, kind of to your point earlier, Phil, like he signed on to do a franchise, but it was under the guise of being this very different thing. He didn't sign up for a Marvel movie. He didn't sign up for a Star Wars movie. He signed up to do Denis Villeneuve's Dune. And for me, the scene where he becomes, and I'm going to read it out loud because I don't want to fuck up the pronunciation, Lisan al-Gaib. I know that Javier Bardem says it a lot, but the scene where he declares himself that, to me, that was like Timothée Chalamet, the man, arrived. Like that was, I saw it. Now he's not grizzled, he doesn't have the beard, but the power he brought to that scene, I was like, oh, he's a man now. He's a man who's about to make a huge fucking mistake, and piss Chani off and fuck all the shit up. But he is a man. So I agree with you guys. I think it should be a couple years. I think, again, this is coming from just, you know, Wikipedia deep dives, but I want to say Dune Messiah is like 12 years later. The other thing is, and this gets into spoilers for the movie, but from my understanding, being a Wikipedia reader, in the book, Chani doesn't leave. And because she does in the movie, we're sort of deviating here. So I don't know, maybe they're planting seeds for what didn't really seem filmable within Messiah. Maybe they're going to do something different.
I agree with you that his ascent within Dune Part 2 is very well realized, right? That you really are seeing the boy from the first one mature into a leader by the end of this movie. And I agree that there is a gravity and a heft to the way that he approaches it, which does give a sense of sort of, you know, manhood or whatever you want to associate with it. And I do think that Chalamet is a great actor, a much better actor than I think people give him credit for sometimes. And I think that he's got a lot more range than perhaps people give him credit for. But this movie also, the second book is very talky. Apparently Messiah doesn't have a ton that happens in it. So like there's a whole lot of things that need to be hurdles that need to be sort of figured out. And it does sound as though Villeneuve wants to make another movie, that there's going to be time that it's going to take to write this script. Like, there's all sorts of things, but 12 years is not going to be. Warner Brothers isn't waiting 12 years for a fucking sequel to this movie, Emily, despite what you think.
Let me tell you this. I think it would be smart of them to do so.
I know you do.
Not just because of the Chalamet thing. I think these movies are big, but I think they are big among kind of a select audience. Does that make sense? Like, they're huge. They are not world dominating blockbusters in the way that
Star Wars,
Barbie was, like Star Wars is, like MCU was at one time. They are very much like, I don't think Dune Part 2 is going to make $1 billion. And I think that they need to get to a place where, I use my sister as an example of someone, she lives in the middle of the country. She doesn't see a lot of movies. She's not clamoring to watch Dune. They need to get her into Dune. And I think that's going to take a while. This needs to filter down a little bit.
Sure.
I do think that's kind of the thing standing in Chalamet's way is these are big. These are not Titanic, you know, these are not like the biggest movie of all time.
100%. I mean, I guess I would say too that, you know, what's funny is that they pushed Dune, as we know, it was supposed to come out at the end of last year, and then because of the actors and writers strike, and they wanted this cast obviously to be out doing promotion and what have you, they decided to push it to March, which I actually think is going to ultimately work out really well for them, because this year is a little thinner, gave them some space. Also, I mean, you want to release Wonka and Dune within literally like weeks of each other, I think is insane. But you're absolutely right, Emily. It's not going to make $1 billion. I think it'll probably get to around 6 or 7 when everything is said and done, all told. But like, it does need time on streaming services. It does need time to sort of get people talking. And I agree, you need a build. But like I said, less than 5 years, we're going to get a Dune sequel. Whether you like it or not.
Let's put money on this.
I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe it's a little bit longer, but it's also, you run the risk of any number of things happening in people's careers or their personal lives. It's like, that's why these sequels are always so close to each other. They just don't want to risk someone, you know, falling in a well.
And we also have the Bene Gesserit TV show coming. So that's just going to get people all sorts of hyped.
What if Zendaya fell in a well? I would rescue her. I just want Zendaya, if you're listening, I will rescue you from the well.
There's a movie, by the way. But I also think it's worth noting too that the Timothy Chalamet stardom, which I think is a little atypical. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that his fandom doesn't feel like, for instance, Leo's felt around, let's just say around, you know, Titanic, for instance, right? You know, obviously a different era, a different time. We have social media now, blah, blah, blah. But still, like, I just, whenever I see him interviewed, he seems like a pretty down-to-earth guy. It doesn't seem to have gone to his head for what that's worth. But he also seems like a little bit of a weirdo. in a good way.
He's a theater kid. He's a theater kid.
Yeah.
But also like a rapper who's dating a Kardashian or a Jenner or something like that. So it's like, there's just a lot of, I got a lot of questions about the guy. Not a bad way.
A thing that I'm thinking about now, about Timothy Chalamet's career, which is a thing that I think about a lot, obviously.
Yes.
Is like, okay, so yes, Dune is probably going to top out around 700, 800 million, as I think what the estimates I've read. Wonka made 600 million. Yeah. I don't know that there's a lot of overlap there. You know, obviously, obviously there's like a ton of fucking people who saw both, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think that the Wonka super fans and the Dune super fans are probably very different groups of people. Totally. It's going to be interesting to watch him navigate like that like chasm he's built for himself.
It's actually just a bridge that's my two arms holding from the various sides is what
it is. It's just you holding him. Yeah.
Because I'm on the record on this show as loving Wonka and now with this episode Dune Part 2. So
I love them both too. We can help. We can have it all.
Good. Wonka, great.
Wonka, like, good.
I think that I went into Wonka expecting it to be a disaster. I couldn't have gone in with lower expectations. And within 5 minutes, I was like, this is charming. This is working. But Emily, to your point, like, I think it's a testament to the fact that he can do both those things. And it's not even about range so much as that audiences are willing to accept him at these sort of different pillars in terms of like, I'll believe him as this sort of, what would you say? Is Wonka asexual, Emily?
I think Wonka had a great love when he was 15. And that he lost the ability to love again after that love was taken from him and poured into some chocolate.
So his love drowned in chocolate.
It made him the greatest chocolatier of all time, but it also meant he could never feel things again. That's canon. That's in Dahl.
That's in Wonka.
Emily, you been in boardrooms pitching your Wonka sequel? Because this seems very thought out and beautiful.
It's called Wonka Vision. And it's gonna be a rom com, but not at all. It's gonna be a non romantic rom com.
The first romantic comedy with no co lead.
Yeah.
Wonka is what Fonzie Bear says, right?
Wonka. It'll be like Beetlejuice. No. Yeah, I think, now that we're talking about this, I think the thing that Chalamet needs to do, and this started out as a joke in my brain, and now I'm talking myself into it, which is how you know it's a good idea. They need to make another fucking Phantom of the Opera movie, and it needs to be Chalamet. He needs
to be
Phantom.
If he can sing? Oh, I guess he could. Wonka, he proved he can sing, sort of. Yeah.
I mean, he's not like a vocalist, but he can... Yeah, I mean,
Gerard
Butler in that movie, okay? Like, anyone can sing.
He's going to be better than Gerard Butler. Like,
I'm very curious to see sort of, I mean, obviously he's about to play Bob Dylan. I'm assuming he's going to sing in that as well. I'm curious about that movie just because I'm not the biggest James Mangold fan. Like, I think he's a solid B-plus filmmaker that I get kind of marginally excited about his movies. But I do think that in this movie and in Dune 1 as well, one of the things that really hit me, and I'm obviously curious what you guys think, was sort of the scene in the first Dune when he says to Lady Jessica, like, you've made me a freak, like you've birthed me into this weird fucking god character or whatever, and seeing him grow into the quote-unquote letting his freak flag fly, if you will, by the end of the second movie, and sort of seeing that growth, I thought was really fascinating to watch. Like, I would argue that Dune 2 is more Chani's movie than Paul's movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I just really think that Paul gives him so many shades to show and gears to run with. It's just really impressive.
Can we just talk about the Bene Gesserit? Because they're my favorite they're my favorite fucking thing about Dune. Like, I'm obsessed with them. The thing about them is they're working right now. Like, in the Dune world, the Bene Gesserit have been working for millennia upon millennia to birth Timothy Chalamet, which, okay. And, like, So like right now out there in our world, like just a bunch of ladies who like gather together and wear weird veils and have tattoos and are like, how's the breeding program going? And someone's like, I don't know. I'm really having trouble getting this particular bloodline to work over here. And it's all like a little bit racist, but also like a little bit mystical, but also like a little bit more racist. And it's all very fun. And
well,
good.
It feels appropriate that Charlotte Rampling.
Plays. Exactly. In a corner, Charlotte Rampling is scowling, which is probably happening at all times, but I like to imagine. Imagine it's in the Bene Gesserit.
I was like talking about how hot I found Austin Butler on some social media platform, and somebody was like, listen, I'm a gay man, but I found Charlotte Rampling hot as fuck in 2-2. And I was like, cool. Good. We're all learning about ourselves.
There was a TikTok I saw last night of this woman dressed up like a Bene Gesserit, and she like sort of scurries into the doorway of her TV room and says to her husband, take me to Target. And it was just, there's something fucking incredible about it.
So they're making this Bene Gesserit show, and it says it's set 10,000 years before Dune, which is like kind of right now. So is this just like, is this just like fucking 30 something? But every so often they have to like go to like a weird cult meeting, but then it all breaks up and they're like, you know what? I do have to run to Target. I have to pick some stuff up. And then it's just like, we're having trouble conceiving. We can't have a baby. And the other person's like, oh, I'm so sorry, but I have foreseen in the skies that it will happen.
I mean, I can only assume that there's hundreds of them that have drank the thing of life, whatever it's called.
Yeah, how the and fuck? Died. How the fuck are they doing that right now when we don't have access to worm blood? How are they? How is this working?
The person that realized if you milk a sandworm, you get this a dead sandworm. It seems
it's actually the same person they hired to design the AMC popcorn bucket.
I didn't get one. I'm so fucking bummed. I didn't get one.
I was debating, and then I realized when my boyfriend, who's a giant Swiftie, didn't get the Taylor Swift popcorn bucket, I found the strength to realize that I don't need the Dune popcorn bucket.
There was a Taylor Swift popcorn
bucket? Yeah, I have one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. How did I miss that?
How did you miss that, Emily?
I don't actually need a Taylor Swift popcorn bucket. I don't need more things.
But
you guys are best friends. You'll get one from her. I mean, it's a matter of time, really.
Phil, when you brought up the TikToks, I was going to say this is part of when you know a movie has like reached a cultural kind of behemoth is when like the memes start, which like, you know, much like the Nicole Kidman ad, you're sort of a little frustrated at first that like art has become memeified, but then you see a tweet that says like Bene Gesserit voice, no worries if not, like that's, and then you're like, oh, that's funny, like, oh, okay, like I get it. And I think that's, you know, kind of what you were saying, Phil, about like Timmy's kind of star power is there is this like he can like show up on set and kill a scene, but I also like envision him like, and he doesn't do this because I don't think he has like a public TikTok, but like you can also see him like making the stupid TikTok, like that's kind of the I feel is one of his charms is you.
His Instagram account is a big part of him for sure. Yes. In terms of like posting a picture that seems apropos of nothing. He's just sitting at a sushi bar with a book and he decides to take a picture of himself and post it on Instagram.
Right.
I so want to fucking time travel to when Timothée Chalamet has a 16-year-old daughter who has a TikTok who's always like taking film of him and just like being like, here's my dad, look at him. And Timothée Chalamet's like, hey, I'm reading Kierkegaard over here. And his daughter's like, do the dance. And he's like, and he does like a dance. Yeah. That's why they need to wait. They need to wait so Timothée Chalamet can have a teenage daughter to be able to promote it on TikTok, Dune 3.
I think that, I mean,
you had me on this show. I'm so sorry.
No, this is incredible. I'm so happy.
This is great content. I'll say this too. I do think that like this press tour has been fascinating as well to watch him sort of, first of all, you got to give Warner Brothers credit. I mean, they've got what, like four of the hottest, and I don't even mean just physically. I mean, just like biggest young stars in Hollywood right now in their movie. So of course they want them everywhere together. And they made sort of, you know, Timmy, Zendaya, Flo, and Austin, these four people just kind of running around, looking beautiful and, you know, giggling and being silly. And I do think that like, there is a shittier movie star that wouldn't be able to share the limelight with these people. And I think that it says a lot about Timothée Chalamet that, like, he loves that this is ensemble, that this movie is filled with all of these characters and filled with all these great actors. And yes, he's number one on the call sheet, I'm sure, but, like, it doesn't feel that way. And I think that that also says a lot about his sort of movie stardom ascension.
I love that they have four of the hottest young stars right now.
Yeah.
And then they're like, we got Anya Taylor-Joy in the chamber. They're just like, also, she's in this for like 5 seconds. And the next one, she's going to have a much bigger part. Yeah, it's...
So in the book, you mentioned this. So the Anya Taylor-Joy character, forgive me, her name is like...
Alia. Yeah.
Alia, yeah. So Alia, in the book, is a small child.
She's
physically there.
The book itself.
Is it a thing where the Spice has her born as like a toddler? Because I've seen the Lynch version once, and I know it was I'm gonna blank on the actress's name, but she's like a. I'll look it up, but okay. She's like a TV actress who you would recognize. I think
Marilyn
she was on
Henner?
Nashville.
Kirstie Alley?
Alicia Witt?
Oh,
that makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes
okay.
Sense. Yeah.
That makes more sense than Mara Lou Henner.
Yes. But now I want to see that movie too. But I say all that to say, like, I didn't know if it was because, to your point earlier, Emily, like, what is this time jump going to be? Like, I didn't know if, like, when Lady Jessica gives birth to this fetus that she speaks to and who speaks back, is it going to be full grown Anya Taylor? Like, how far into the future, like, was that vision? Because we're obviously not.
Well, this is the thing, because it seems to me, and again, I'm basing this solely on friends who have read all the books and have, you know, told me their guesses and what have you. But like in the book and in Lynch's movie, Alia is, I think, like a 5 or 6 year old daughter, right? She's physically outside of the womb and she can see the future and she's able to sort of say all these things and give visions, I guess, to Paul as to sort of where this is all going. I don't believe she's born a toddler or anything like that, but I do think that she ages very quickly. And I think my guess is they just want to fucking get to an actor that means something to people, so they're going to just make her age even faster for Messiah.
I think she's like yeah, I think she's like Renée Esmé in the Twilight films. Yeah. She's just like goes pew. Like, that's my impression of a person aging very fast.
Which is also, like, some lazy fucking writing.
What they do is they just leave her on the old beach for, like, an hour.
Yeah, just let her cook a little.
Yeah. One of my complaints about the Dune films, this is going to be a sincere complaint. Dave Bautista, one of the great, interesting actors right now, all he does is he eats shit. And, like, he's good at it. But it just feels like he should have gotten a stronger part. That's a complaint.
He was better in Blade Runner with his little glasses.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I totally agree with you, Emily. I think that he gets a little bit... It's not that he even gets more to do in part one. It's just that, like, Austin Butler's not there, like, sucking up all the air in the room. And I say that in a complimentary way because Austin Butler should suck up most things in most rooms if it were up to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
I apologize for that visual. But listen, he wanted to put his freak hand in the box, so it's not my fault.
He did.
But I completely agree with you. I do, and this is extra filmic, but I think there was an interview, and this is like part of this great press tour that we've got with like the four hotties. Josh Brolin is releasing his like love poems about all of them, which is also very endearing. And then kind of like under the radar, I think Dave Bautista had a quote where he talked about like, I think he said Denis Villeneuve was like the first director who like told him he was a good actor.
Sure.
And I think it was on Blade Runner. Like, I think he was like, yeah, like Denis was like the first person who was like, yeah, no, like you're actually like dramatically very good in this part. So yeah, it is unfortunate that he doesn't get as much to do, but to your point, Phil, like this being an ensemble movie, like there's just, even with this like 2.5+ hour runtime, there's just so much, you know, that we have to get to. I mean, we've got Christopher Walken sitting in chairs, Bene Gesserit walking around with their big, you know, I completely agree with you, Emily. And not that I found her wasted, but like, it is that thing where like, you only spend so much time with Lady Margot, you only spend so much time with Florence Pugh as Princess Rulian. And you kind of get this whiff of, like, they'll get more to do in the next movie. And I think that retroactively, and I know that, like, there's debates about this, like, our movies, television now, the Marvelification of everything, like, Dune Part 2 makes Dune a better movie. And I'm wondering if when we get Dune Messiah and we have this, like, 8+ out, like, is that going to be the new, like, you know, Lord of the Rings extended version, watch them back to back to back, and people love to do that shit every year.
I mean, I'm curious to see, but yes.
I think Austin Butler should play Kirby in the Kirby movie so he can suck up everything in the room.
What are you talking about?
You know Kirby from Nintendo?
But to your, like,
Kirby. Pink guy?
Yeah. To your point, you know, Villeneuve has been pretty open about the fact that, like, he said this to Florence Pugh, like, you don't have a ton to do in this movie, but you'll have a lot more to do in the third one. Obviously, yeah. Anya Taylor-Joy, I'm assuming, just stepped away from the set of Furiosa for, you know, a couple hours and shot.
No, I think it was the same set. It was just still the red dirt sand.
Yeah, there you go. So she walked from literally, like, one camera to another. But, I think it's pretty obvious that those characters will be much more fleshed out. The love triangle that they're building, for lack of a better way of putting it, that doesn't so much exist in the book, mm-hmm. but I think is smartly the sort of ellipse at the end of this movie. I mean, every movie should end with the heartbreaking and furious face of Zendaya. You know, it's just, who's not going to show up and see whatever hell she is going to bring down on everybody. So I do wonder what these three films will feel like when they're all said and done. I agree with everything Emily's saying, too, that, like, I don't know that Dune will ever be a Lord of the Rings type phenomenon. I don't know that it can ever really get there. I mean, I watched this movie, I saw it twice, and the second time I was sitting in the theater, and I was just like, it's crazy that these movies, A, exist, and B, are making as much money as they are. Because these are deeply strange movies. Like, these are like, you know, it's not wizards and elves and shit like that. This is like space witches, I guess.
One of the knocks against making Dune as a movie was how much Star Wars lifts from it.
Yes.
Star Wars is basically Dune and John Carter of Mars's love child. Mm-hmm. And it, like, it takes everything complicated about Dune and sands the rough edges off. And, like, these movies are unapologetically weird, yes. But also that means they don't have a, like, clear good versus evil conflict. This movie kind of does, until the end of it is like, but also now this guy is possibly evil. How do you feel about that? He's your protagonist. But the thing that I find sort of fascinating about all of this, and I've spoiled myself enough on Dune Messiah to know that Florence Pugh is not going to get to play a very, like, interesting character in that books that film. So
if they do it a straight adaptation of it,
I mean, there's not, the problem is there's not a lot of room to maneuver within, like, the larger Dune mythology. But also, maybe they just tear it apart because those books aren't as beloved as the first one. Anyway, I do think that this movie, my big criticism of it is, and I like this movie a lot, to be clear, it tries to deconstruct the white savior mythos, the messiah mythos, and also do a white savior messiah story. It's trying to have its cake and eat it too. And I think it mostly succeeds, but there are moments where you can feel it, like the tension just pulling so taut that the movie almost snaps. And it really only holds together because it has Zendaya in it. And, like, obviously it has Zendaya in it, so great. But it very much is like a case of, if she had not been there, I think this movie would have, like, turned into something that would be kind of ugly in a weird way. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, when I saw it the first time, what really, I mean, the thing that made the most impact on me the first time I watched it was the love story, right? Like, they're so charismatic, they have a tremendous amount of chemistry, and the love story is what really pulled me through it. And I think, to your point, Emily, without that as sort of the ballast or sort of the bearing walls of the movie, I think that so much importance would ultimately be put onto the white savior messiah sort of complex that exists within this movie. So I agree with you. I think that Zendaya is breathing life and love and blood into this thing that could have otherwise felt icky, to say the least. Yeah.
There is this thing that Frank Herbert ran into through publishing these novels, which was, no, actually, Paul is not a great guy. No, you should not want ultimate power. Ultimate power mm-hmm. will corrupt you. You should not want to be a god emperor. And he would try to make it more explicit in every book. And the fans would just be like, I want to be god emperor. To the degree where he was like, I'm going to make this guy a worm. How do you feel about that? And the fans were like, fuck yeah, I want to be a worm. But it is this thing that happens in every property of this type, except for maybe Lord of the Rings, where there is inevitably a substantial portion of the fan base, fascists, that is like, I want to be just like these like terrible people. And Dune is like trying to put a like shine a spotlight on that, especially in the films, but also in the books from what I've read. And yet it is very much like, how many people, I saw Ben Shapiro talking about this movie, and you should never listen to Ben Shapiro's movie takes because he doesn't know how to watch film. He's a failed screenwriter. But like, you know, there is this element of how many people are watching this movie and being like, yes, fuck yes, this guy is now going to kill billions of people. That's exactly what I've been waiting to see. And I don't need Denis Villeneuve to be responsible for those reactions, but it does feel like the movie is simultaneously trying to please both me, someone who's skeptical of that narrative, and all the people who think that narrative is fun. And it's a tension that like this movie sustains beautifully. That also has me being like, do I need to see another one of these?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, what's interesting about what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you, Emily, you know, there's two things. The first is the casting of Timothée Chalamet, right? Which is this up and coming actor that has this very, you know, has a fan base, has a lot of girls that are really into him, and trying to, in its own way, deconstruct that notion within the film as well. On the flip side also, Emily, you know, we've obviously talked at length about the Matrix movies.
Oh, yeah.
That's another example of like, if I guarantee you, if you make a movie that is successful somewhere, the right will try to co-opt it and misread it entirely. Like, that's just the way it goes.
The one exception is Barbie, because they called their shot there as like, this movie's going to flop, and then they totally failed. So I guess the only way to subvert it is to make it about a girl. So,
but I do think that like the Neo comparison, right, of that sort of Messiah, the one who can save us all, is, you know, is there too.
Yeah. I was just going to say that based on what we've seen and how I feel like Chani is given, I don't want to say more to do because I haven't read the book, so I can't compare it. But given how the movie ends with Chani leaving, and then this is the point I wanted to bring up, I totally agree with you, Emily. I think that to a large degree, the movie is having its cake and eating it too, which is just kind of the double-edged sword of populist art. I think, and I thought about this more on a rewatch because I'd seen reaction to it. So I saw it opening night in Dolby. I saw it again a couple days later at a local theater that was doing 70mm. I'm seeing it again next weekend. So like, spoiler alert, I did really like this movie. So I'd seen this reaction, and I don't think it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong that at the end of the movie, when Paul proposes marriage to Princess Arulian and Chani leaves, I don't think she is, of course, mad because of the romantic betrayal. But on a second watch, I thought so much more about how she was mad at him betraying who she wanted him to be and who he said he was going to be, which obviously ties into the romantic part of it too. But on a mm-hmm. second watch, the anger on Zendaya's face to me read way more of a damnation of the choices he was making as a leader and less about like, oh, so you're just going to marry this other girl now.
I agree with that. And again, this is, I think, a testament to how good the movie is, that there are various levels and readings to it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, before she, there's that scene she has with James Brolin in that sort of prayer, sort of chapel-esque kind of situation, right, where he keeps pulling her down and she's standing up and there's this whole, and then it's inverted later on. But that sort of him just telling her to sort of like, you know, to keep her mouth shut and to sort of not rock the boat, and sort of the way that she sees the Fremen people as opposed to the way that it seems everybody else does, and her frustrations, as you're saying, in terms of the way that Timothy is manipulating them to a certain degree, I think obviously is very upsetting to her. But then on top of everything else, in the book, spoiler for the book and potentially the movie, but she's pregnant in the book, at the end of the book. So again, I understand, first of all, them hiding the ball on that. Three pregnancies in one movie is probably one too many pregnancies. So I get it. I also just don't think that you needed it. Like, I think that the audience feels jilted, for lack of a better way of putting it, at the end of the film, and they're obviously rooting for Chani. Mm-hmm. So I think it all works out, but I agree with you that, like, it's a mixture of that whole sort of hurricane of emotions.
And, like, a thing that I think this movie chose to elide that the book does that might have smoothed over some of the things in this film is there's, like, a 2-year time jump. Dune, the book, is split into two parts because it was published in two halves, and then now all you can get is the one thing. And, like, that's basically where Dune Parts 1 and 2 break down. And, like, there's, like, a 2-year time jump, and now there's a baby, Alia, and all this stuff has happened. And it's, like, I do feel like there's a lot of stuff that happens in this movie that feels like it needs a little bit more breathing room. Not in the sense of, like, scene-wise and dramatic-wise. It works dramatically, but in the sense of, like, I got very hung up on how long is all of this taking? Because it feels like it feels like you can cross Arrakis in a day if you commit yourself to it. And I don't know that that should be true. And again, this is not like a real complaint. It is very much a sense of, it feels to me like the people who love Dune, like, could go on at great length about all of the elements of this in the way that people who love Middle Earth or the Star Wars universe could. And the film is, like, very much like, what Denis is interested in is the politics. And I think that's the thing I would be most interested in too. But it definitely feels like when he'll get to, like, the mysticism, he'll be like, sure. Yeah. Let's have this guy drink some worm blood. It looks like Windex. It's great. Sounds good.
I agree with you, Emily, that there are definitely, there are moments you just wish you could kind of sit in it for a second and be able to kind of take it in. And I think that those are the real estate, if you will, of that is taken up with, and I love this stuff, but sort of this impressionistic visuals that Denis loves, of sort of putting you in this kind of visual poetry of the world of Arrakis and what have you. But another thing that I think is one of, if I had to say a complaint I had about this film, is the geography is a little bit confusing to me. There are times where I was like, oh, there's a northern Arrakis, and there's like I really don't geographically understand where we are a lot of the time, outside of, like, when we're just in the fucking desert and I'm like, okay, so we're in the desert. But I do think that, unlike a Game of Thrones, for instance, or even a Middle Earth, you know, you do have a sense of the geography. I didn't really get a sense of that in this.
Yeah,
these are nitpicky things, but
no, I love this movie. It's probably gonna end up somewhere in my top 20 at the end of the year, if not top 10.
For sure.
And it's just like, yeah, my complaints about it are more like complaints about society. but it very much is like, I think what is the interesting thing about the tension we've identified in this movie is it's the tension of trying to make a thing right now. Because we are so much more aware of these oppressive power structures that we all exist within and that we're all trying to interrogate and tear down, but the only thing you can get made is, like, spin-offs of things that already exist. So you're going to adapt Dune, which has all this stuff baked into it, and you can interrogate it, but at the end of the day, you know, you have to end it with Paul doing what he does, or else it's not Dune. And I think Denis, like Frank Herbert, really has his eye on how terrible this is. But at the same time, it's just like, the second you start telling that story, you're unleashing something kind of terrible, which is also what Dune is about. So it all kind of, like, turns into an Ouroboros. I did just love when Timothy Chalamet was like, they call it Arrakis, but it had another name. And he says, Dune. And you're like, yeah.
Dune. I mean, it is interesting what you're saying, Emily, of, like, And it's why I think so many people, fans of the books, fans of the movies, are so curious to see what the third one will be, especially the fans of the books, because of Paul's downfall, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I do imagine that they're going to try to round the edges off that to some degree and not, you know, not perhaps fully commit to Paul, you know, falling apart at the seams. But I don't know. I mean, it'll be curious.
I think that's why you cast Chalamet. Like, I think he's an actor who can play that kind of thing beautifully, as we all saw in Lady Bird. And like, it's this is the thing, Dane. You gotta give me 45 minutes. I'm like a horse that needs to be trained. You gotta give me 45 minutes to just get my spirit out and just like buck around a little bit. And you gotta keep me tied. And then I just am like, okay, I'll play along. I'll have takes.
Yeah, this is what it's like co-hosting with Emily. You just gotta let her do her thing. She's like a toddler. You gotta let her work herself.
As soon as Emily gave the Homeland season 2, I was reminding myself of what Timmy's character name was. I was coming up with Homeland season 2. Like, I will meet you where you are.
Let's do a Homeland season 2 episode. Let's make this happen.
Your journey with Timothy is your own, and I want to focus on Homeland season 2 if that's where you're at emotionally.
I will say that, you know, one of the things I think about most, I guess, to some degree, weirdly, it's something that stayed with me about Timmy, is an interview he did years ago when he was talking about how disappointed he was in how little he was in Interstellar.
Mm-hmm.
And how
he went home and cried after the premiere.
He went home and cried after the premiere because he was just like, I fucked it up, right? Like, I was basically cut out of this movie. I barely had any lines. And obviously, Chris Nolan was like, dude, you know, the movie's really long, and you know, it wasn't obviously an indication of Timothy's performance. But every time I see him now, sort of, you know, raising the bar for himself, becoming essentially a movie star, I just think about that kid that went home and cried after the Interstellar premiere and was like, you know, good on you, man. You fucking, you made it. You did it. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not
Nolan
easy.
Nolan should work with him again. Now that, like,
absolutely,
now that Christopher Nolan has directed a movie that made nearly $1 billion and won Best Picture, he should just join up with Timothy Chalamet and just like take over the world. Actually, he should make Tenet 2. That's what he should do.
Well, Tenet 2, I think, would be great. Yeah. And do you think it's funny you say that? Because, like, there's a world where, like, I could see Timothy Chalamet in the R-Pats role. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
I had to, Dane, this is an important story to talk about Tenet on this podcast. But I was Tenet pilled from the first. And like,
okay, so you were ahead of the curve.
I loved it. I watched it at home. I didn't see it in a theater. Obviously, it was 2020. It was sad. And my wife hated it. She fell asleep in the middle of it. And I was just like, this is so good. And she was like, what was it about? And I was like, it was about sometimes you just know when a guy's your friend. And I was, and she was like,
it's about loving other men.
Explain the plot to me. And I was like, the plot is that sometimes when you're a bro, you just meet a bro and you just know.
Yeah.
And then I went and saw it in a beautiful, like, digital presentation in a theater, and was like even more blown away by it. And like, for a while I was saying it was my favorite Christopher Nolan film. Now it's Oppenheimer, but it's way up there. Mm-hmm. I fucking love it. I think it's
I get it.
The most Emily of
that
things.
Is the thing I like about Dune, though. Like, Dune is like, yeah, there's a plot, but it's mostly vibes. Yeah. If you sit down and say what the plot is, it sounds absurd.
Yeah.
I was going to bring this up at some point earlier, and I realized it didn't really fall into the archetype too much. But there are one of my favorite archetypes in movies, and it's very apparent in Power of the Dog and May December. It's what I call Weasley Little Faggot Wants to Protect His Problematic Mother, which is what happens in those two movies. And when that happened in May December, I was thrilled. And watching Dune Part 2, I was like, all right, it's not exactly that. However, there are shades.
It's not that.
It's not that. And the other point I wanted to bring up, Emily, is I love your Tenet opinion. I think that most opinions we had on art in 2020 and 2021 should be forgiven and understood, much how I think that Jungle Cruise is a 4.5-star movie.
I've never seen it. I bet it's good. I bet it's good.
I think you'd like Jungle Cruise, Emily.
I loved it. Jungle Cruise and The French Dispatch were supposed to come out on the same day in July 2020, and little did we know.
I feel like Jungle Cruise is the end of the Walt Disney machine. Like, that was the last time they were able to just, like, push a movie over the edge. And then we were all like, we're tired of this, right? And, like, America was like, yes, we are.
And then they fired Sean Bailey.
Yeah, no, I think that, like, well, the nice thing about my opinion about Tenet is that it's the correct one. So, we're...
Sure. I've come around on Tenet. I mean, this is your thing, Emily. I'm just like, and he says it a bunch in the movie, and Chris Nolan has said it in interviews, like, just don't think about Tenet too much. Like, the more you think of, like, just go with it. That's kind of the fun of the movie, if you will. But I also think the movie is also begging you most of the time to be trying to actually understand what the fuck is going on. So it's like, there's a little bit at odds.
This is like an interesting comparison point with Villeneuve, actually. I'm going to make this work. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a thing in Nolan's career where Interstellar is like this movie where it's pretty clear that he was just like, I'm kind of done with logic. I just want you to feel things. And like, every movie he's made since then has been that. Even Oppenheimer, which is about literal science, is like, I want to put you in this guy's indecision, in this guy's anxiety, in this guy's guilt. Villeneuve feels to me like he's had a similar thing happen since Arrival, but he's a little bit more all over the place. Like, Blade Runner 2049, I find a deeply emotional film, but a lot of people find that movie very cold. What I think is interesting about Villeneuve is, like, he is a cold filmmaker, but in a way that I think once you sort of can crack through it is immensely warm. And I feel like this is the closest he's come to knitting those two sides of himself together. Functionally, Arrival and Blade Runner 2049 seem like they have very different emotional tones. And this movie seems like it kind of knits them together in a way that even the first Dune did not. It is a very warm film that holds you at a distance, which is a hard thing to pull off.
I think Villeneuve and Nolan both love Terrence Malick. I think they both love the idea of film as art, right? Like, quite literally, that idea of eliciting emotion with visuals and what that means, right? I mean, the first hour almost of Oppenheimer is like a really, really crazy Terrence Malick movie. And I think that, you know, similarly to what you're saying, Emily, that like Villeneuve seems, I mean, they did a Q&A, the two of them, during after a screening of Tenet actually recently at City Walk, which is on YouTube if people want to watch it. And it's great. It's really interesting to hear them both talk about their approaches. But like Villeneuve storyboards his movies to death. Like, he is a visual artist. He draws basically the entire script out as storyboards, then goes to set, and he isn't slavish to the visual, to the storyboards. He's willing to throw them away, but he needs to have them just to sort of have them to give him that sort of ballast to work from. And whereas Nolan doesn't storyboard any of his stuff. And I just think that they are sort of two sides of a similar coin, to Emily's point. He's being given basically as much money as he wants to do whatever he wants now. And you're seeing that freedom. And it's so rare that a filmmaker actually fills that freedom properly. Nolan is an example of it, obviously. But when you think about how many filmmakers are given those sort of blank check, if you will, to do kind of whatever they want, and how few of them can actually execute on it, I do think it's a testament to the fact that, like, Villeneuve is a great storyteller.
I do wonder if the difference between Nolan and Villeneuve is just the difference between the United Kingdom and Canada. That feels right to me on some weird level.
So this is a Commonwealth thing?
Yeah, and then George Miller's Australia. So
my only asterisk to that is I was going to pull the James Cameron into it all, but he is also famously Canadian. So I don't know if Cameron or Villeneuve is going to be like the more authoritative. Maybe Villeneuve just brings in the more of the French voice to it. I feel like
Villeneuve is a far more esoteric and strange, almost more, I hate to say, but international vibe.
James Cameron is Canadian, but deep in his bones, he's like Hollywood core. He just like is just like,
well, you know what? He did come to my film school, and he did go to my film school in Toronto.
I'm just saying, like his core being is like a guy who would be making, you know, he would still be making Piranha sequels, you know, like he's just like, he makes amazing films. He's one of my favorite filmmakers, but he's very much like, he cannot get out of the, his personal vision overlaps so much with like the kinds of movies that Hollywood has traditionally made. Whereas both Nolan and Villeneuve have had to like warp Hollywood to their purposes.
I totally agree with that. I will say, and just to play devil's advocate a little bit, but I do think it's an interesting to bring for you, Dane, to bring Cameron into this. I think it's interesting because Cameron does feel a little bit agnostic from a country perspective, if that makes sense. Like, I don't look at his films. They're not particularly jingoistic. I mean, True Lies is the closest, I would say. Yeah. There is always a military component in his films, but it doesn't necessarily feel as though it's like an American military per se.
Yeah.
It's just interesting how he is a little bit sort of, he's no Michael Bay.
He loves soldiers and he loves military equipment. And he hates war.
He loves it as a means to an end for him to put his money on screen.
Dane, say James Cameron is like, I need Timothy Chalamet to play a Na'vi. Do you think Timothy Chalamet should do it?
Absolutely. Yes. Because I also love James Cameron. I have a Titanic tattoo.
What is your tattoo? You must tell us what your Titanic tattoo is of.
My favorite scene in all film is when Kate Winslet comes out of the car in the beginning and comes out from under her big purple hat.
Oh, that's amazing.
Hell yeah.
That's
Thank you. The funny thing about it is my great friend Helen, who's been on the show, did the illustration. And one thing I love about her aesthetic is she will do portraits without faces. And then when I showed my grandmother my tattoo, she said, well, are you going to put the face in there? Which I just found very funny.
I do think, though, if Timmy was a Na'vi, you know he'd love the dreadlocks.
Absolutely. Which, God, now, like, how would I even begin to, like, confront that hair? I mean, we have to talk about the hair on this show, and I just don't even know how I would feel that one.
Yeah. To sort of return us to the tangent I got us on, I was looking at Villeneuve's filmography, and like Arrival is for me when he starts making sense. I liked Enemy, which is about a giant spider, because I like giant spiders. But like, you know, I wasn't a huge Prisoners fan. Some of his other stuff, Sicario, I was kind of cold to. It does feel to me like there's a thing that works when he starts making sci-fi. That just is like, there is a tone to him that works within science fiction. I think when I think about the film Incendies, like there's a fatalism to everything that Villeneuve makes. He's interested sort of in the idea that we are trapped within programs that we cannot escape. And like Dune is like a totemic work in his life. He read it when he was a kid and loved it or whatever. And like, you can see that influence on all of his work. He's interested in this idea that we are trapped in patterns that we are like impossible for us to break free of. Arrival is literally about like, what if you suddenly knew everything that was ever going to happen to you? And like Blade Runner 2049 is about somebody who is programmed. And that works so well in sci-fi. But the second you like put it into a film like Incendies, like it does start, to me, it starts to feel very cruel and calculated. And not like life. Like life needs to feel messy. But sci-fi is like a great place to do, oh, you're fated to do this. Paul, it's inescapable. You must go and drink of the worm. And like it works so well here. And I definitely like sort of wonder, however, can he get some of what makes him so compelling in like, I don't know, just making like a rom-com?
I do think, though, I don't disagree with you, Emily, but I wonder if there's another element to it as well, because I think that, like, we were talking about Nolan and Interstellar, and I think that Interstellar is, without a doubt, the most open-hearted Nolan movie. It is the most sort of, literally, love and is the motivating factor of that movie. It was developed by Spielberg prior to being put into Nolan's hands, and you can feel a little bit of his fingerprints on it, of just being, it's a father-daughter story, right? Like, it's just open-hearted. And I think that the transition that happens for Villeneuve on Arrival is that it becomes emotional, right? Like, there's just Prisoners, which I just rewatched actually and quite like, is a fucking tough hang. Most of his movies are just tough hangs, and then Arrival, it's like a switch gets flipped, and I think sci-fi gives him, to your point, Emily, a way or a vessel into being heartfelt and human in a way that I don't think he ever was.
I think there is a thing that someone was talking about how Villeneuve is like the new choice of film bros, and I don't know how true that is, but I think what people talk about when they talk about film bro cinema is like films made by directors who feel like they have mathematically figured out the universe and like know where all the equations go. And Villeneuve's like that. Fincher's like that. Nolan's obviously like that. Mm-hmm. And like they have mathematically solved what a good movie is, and you can watch their movies and you'll know what a good movie is. And like, and yet the further these guys get into their career, the more interested they are in messy shit, you know, just like the kind of stuff that happens in life. When we talk about Villeneuve's early films being tough hangs, which I think is true, it's often just like they're movies that assume that the worst is going to happen in a weird way, if that makes sense, that we are fated to be trapped in the worst possible thing. Yeah. They're movies that are like...
They're brutal.
They're movies that are like maladaptive trauma responses, where like everything that happens is just the worst possible thing is going to happen next. And again, I think that's more palatable in genre, not just because like there's that level of remove, but because in genre you can attach like, I mean, science fiction, fantasy, horror evolved out of religious storytelling way back in the day. Mm-hmm. And like religion is how we explain bad things. So I feel like genre storytelling has this element of like the worst possible. Paul Atreides can launch a genocide that's going to kill billions upon billions of people. And you're like, well, yeah, you know, he had to, like, that's just what his trauma, his maladaptive trauma response from being raised by millennia of witch priestesses who like, were like, I'm going to manipulate all of space and time to make sure this kid's born. And then his girlfriend's like, I don't want you being a messiah. And he's like, I don't want to be a messiah. But Javier Bardem's like, hey, you're the messiah. And like, he's like, I don't actually want to do that. And then his mom's like, but you kind of have to be the messiah. And he's like, I guess I'll drink of the worm. Like, it's like
his mom did make him drink the juice that makes
like,
you bad.
It's just like, that is a thing where like the scale of it is so over the top that you're like, okay, this is like a way to talk about this stuff. I think a lot about storytelling around trauma, and I think telling stories around trauma in a realistic setting is often self-defeating because it just like it becomes difficult to approach the scale of it or to depict the scale of it, because inevitably like what storytelling wants is a third act, and like a third act is impossible when you're dealing with any form of mental illness, especially PTSD. And like what science fiction and fantasy gives us is an out, where you're like, you can tell this story metaphorically, and then at the end you can do the conclusion. And I think that's a thing Villeneuve does possibly better than anyone working right now. But it's also why I'm like, the second he's like, it's finally time for me to make my Thomas Edison biopic, I'm gonna be like, are you sure you want to do that?
I love that you bring that up, Emily, because as we were talking about Villeneuve and how Arrival is this switch. It's like Arrival is this moment where, I mean, Arrival, he literally casts a female lead. But then even after that, with Ryan Gosling and especially Timothy Chalamet, there is this like, I don't want to say it's like the antithesis of toxic masculinity, because I don't think you can get into the jihad of it all with Paul Atreides without getting into toxic masculinity. But with actors like Ryan Gosling and Timothy Chalamet, there is this androgynous, less gendered, I can't think of a word better than like softer energy that I think that he is interested in exploring. And I think it starts with Arrival.
There's so much like, so many trans guys I know are like, feel so drawn to Ryan Gosling in Blade Runner 2049, where they're like, this guy's understanding of his masculinity, for lack of a better word, is so similar to like how I perceive masculinity. And like, it is very much, that's a movie about a robot trying to like figure out social codes. So like trans people have been drawn to stories about people trying to figure out social codes around gender for forever. And there's so many like trans women who are looking at Paul Atreides and like claiming him for us. I'm going to try and find this like, okay, here we go. This is what Paul, in order to win the respect of the Fremen and become the emperor, you have to ride the biggest worm in the land. You have to change your name. Drink this blue stuff for girls. Have you been practicing the voice? He is a trans girl.
No, Emily, that's so apt, because I think, and again, this is coming from my Wikipedia deep dive, other than just seeing the movies both twice. The whole reason Paul was born is because his mom betrayed the Reverend Mother before she became the Reverend Mother and had a boy instead of a girl.
Exactly.
So there is this really interesting parallel there.
Yeah, it's very much like, it's very gendered in an interesting way. And it's like, the second they were like, no man has ever drank the poison and lived, I was like, well, you know what? I bet I could pull that off. Like, because I'm a lady.
There's also the Jared Leto character in Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
That's a whole thing as well.
It's like Villeneuve is interested in gender play without knowing he's interested in gender play. And if you told him that's what he was doing, it would, the whole thing would fall apart. Because he'd be like, is that what I'm up to? And you'd be like, no, 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 you, no, you're not.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it, buddy.
I mean, I do think that there, yeah, I mean, I didn't really watch Dune necessarily through the lens of gender per se, but I do think that there is, I mean, I don't know what's going on with Fade. I mean, that's a whole thing unto itself as well with the Austin Butler character.
Yeah.
Sure. No, super hot, but also like, I don't, there's a lot of stuff going on with that character that I don't really get. I also, just for a very brief second, we got to talk about what were those black creatures that had those big like horns in the, do you know what I'm talking about? In the Colosseum thing, where they were basically there to make sure that the one guy who wasn't drugged that he had to fight didn't like fight back too hard. Like, there's this whole weird sort of, that's the other thing too about Fade. Like, there is almost this kind of an incel-y vibe to him of just like he's being coddled by this terrible, you know, father figure, if you will. And you know, he's claiming to be this amazing soldier, this amazing fighter when he's fighting drugged, like, it's just, the whole thing's crazy.
I could fix him. Do you remember, like, incredible. Do you remember when the Elvis discourse was, Austin Butler can't stop doing the voice? And then in this movie, he's doing a pitch-perfect Stellan Skarsgård impression. I hope he stays in that voice the rest of time. It's so great.
Yeah, it's great. Did you want to, Dan, talk about his hair? Did you want to talk about Timmy's hair?
Yeah, let's use this as an opportunity to jump into the peach ratings, because I do want to get to the hair, but I know we got to talk about the ratings here. So let's go around the horn and give our peach ratings, or I guess in this case our sand. If you want to do sandworms, that's fine too.
Sure, sandworms. Sure.
Peaches are just.
Emily wants to do peaches.
I want to do worms.
Dealer's choice on this episode.
Okay.
So for the movie, Phil, let's start with you. How many peaches and or sandworms on a scale from 1 to 5?
Yeah, I mean, I gave this 5 worms, peaches, stars on Letterboxd, so I'm going to stick with I've seen it twice. I think I liked it even more the second time. Similar to Emily, I'll be surprised if this doesn't end up in my favorite films of the year. You know, the funny thing is, I really loved the first one. I thought it was great. I saw it in IMAX once when it came out, and then again when they did the re-release. And I was trying to keep my expectations pretty low on this just because I was like, I don't know. And it exceeded anything that I could have expected. So I thought it was wonderful.
Love it. Emily, what about you? How many sandworms?
Oh, boy. All those worms, baby. I left this movie and was like, I really liked that. I might have preferred the first one. It stuck with me a little bit. I'm going to go 4.5, and I'm probably going to see it again. And I think that depending on that viewing, it'll either go up a half star or lose a half star. It definitely, to me, it felt like a movie where I found the tension it was exploring interesting. And yet I was like, I'm not sure. I think on a second viewing, I'll either find it amazing how skillfully they wrote that tension, or I'll like find the thing in it that makes me go, I'm not so sure about that. I think it has, to an earlier point, I think it has one of the great final shots of the last several years. Really bold to end this vast desert epic on someone's face, but I think it's the right choice. So 4.5 big ol' worms.
Love it. Yeah, I'm also I go by my Letterboxd rating. I gave it 5 peaches, 5 sandworms. This is what, to quote, you know, the holy figure we mentioned earlier, this is what we go to the movies for. This is the magic. This is, you know, we come to this place to laugh, to cry, to care. I just this is what the theatrical experience is to me. We talked about it a bit. It just would have been wild if this movie had come out last year. You know, as we're recording this, we just got through the Oscars, and it's just kind of wild to imagine how that all would have played out with the, because this just, you know, and I think people too tend to be hyperbolic on the internet, go figure, but I think people are correct. Like, this just feels like a movie that has so many, you know, below the line nominations, potentials for Oscars. I think depending on how they play their cards, right? Like, for me, this is like, I don't want to say his best because I'm still just so partial to Call Me By Your Name, but I think this is like an incredible powerhouse turn from Timmy, and we're going to get into his performance, obviously. But I think if they play their cards right, I mean, you know, Oppenheimer came out in July. We're completely revisiting. I think I saw a stat that like this is the first, Oppenheimer's the first Best Picture winner since The Departed that like completely skipped like the festival circuit. So I'm just wondering, like, can Warner Brothers turn this into like a Lord of the Rings type Oscar sweep, if not by wins, at least by nominations?
I'm curious to see how, I mean, this is going to be a pretty thin year. I think that everyone's kind of predicting that there's not a ton coming out this year in the same way that like last year felt like there was a lot.
Yeah.
I think that if this movie had come out against Oppenheimer, it still would have lost everything to Oppenheimer. I think Oppenheimer was a thrasher that was going to basically kill everything in its path.
Yeah.
But I have been reading the same articles, I think, that you have, Dane, about how sort of the festival fall, you know, the whole, there was this time, I think we all remember, where like that Christmas corridor was where you dropped all your big Oscar contenders to some degree or another. Right. And I think that doesn't seem to exist to the same degree that it used to. So I do think that Dune could very well be milked for the year from Warner Brothers, but I'm sure they got other things up their sleeve.
I do think the main reason I'm glad this movie wasn't in the Oscar race this year is because it meant Godzilla Minus One won Best Visual Effects, and I don't think it would have if Dune 2 was in the picture. I think this is going to get a large number of nominations. I don't know that it's going to be, I think it's just too fucking weird to win anything above the line, but I could see them getting Chalamet in. Like, it is pretty clear this is like a big star making moment for him, and they often will give that a nomination, especially in a year that's a little thin.
Yeah. I mean, to bring up my boy, our boy again, I'd love to see him get the James Cameron's Aliens, you know, nomination for Sigourney, like, you know, coming in and just ripping it.
I really do think if ever there was a year, this might be it. In terms of, I mean, listen, Everything Everywhere All at Once came out in March. Like, I mean, it doesn't mean anything anymore. The real question is going to be whether or not this movie has real sustainability in the same way. Like, I do think that, you know, obviously there's going to be sort of the home video release and the streaming release and the this and the that. And I think that if they can stagger that out properly, you know, you could milk this through the summer at the very least in terms of making sure that people still remember it. So.
All right, Phil, let's talk Timmy's performance. How many peaches and or sandworms for our boy Chalamet here?
I mean, I think I'd give him, you know, 4.5 peaches. I mean, I think that I don't know that it's a perfect performance, but I'm also just sort of, I think he's a little bit hamstrung at times in terms of the fact that like the turn that happens is relatively quick, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of sort of the page turning moment for him isn't particularly graceful, but I don't think that's his fault. I think that's on the page in terms of just sort of at a certain point, it becomes clear that they just need to get there. It might be just an editing thing. I don't know, but I did feel like it's a touch jarring. It works. He rises to the occasion. I think he's tremendous in it. The scenes that are always going to work for me are the quieter scenes. The scene where he's watching Chani put together whatever she's putting on the ship, and she's like, stop looking at me like that. Like, he's just so in love with her without saying anything. There is just something so lovely and charming about him in the first half of the movie that, and again, that intoxication is intentional so that when it does start to turn at the end or curdle, it hurts. So I think he's wonderful in it.
Yeah. Emily, how many sandworms are you going to give our boy Timmy on his performance?
I was just looking up what movies have Oscar buzz coming up this year, because I was like, it is kind of thin on the ground. And like, there are a surprising number of like actually pretty significant contenders from major filmmakers, even in a thin year. And yet I got to the bottom of this article and they were like, how about Twisters? And I'm like, yeah, Dune 2 is going to be fine. And like, to be clear, I'm fucking amped for Twisters. I think that movie's going to rule. Timothée Chalamet's 100%. Performance in Dune Part 2, I'm going to give him 4 sandworms. I do think a lot of the problems I have with it are lost in the editing. It just kind of feels like, whoop, mm-hmm. we just like flip a coin and he's on the other side. He's good at both of those parts. Mm-hmm. He's this guy, and it just like, it felt like I was missing maybe one scene that like rode the line mm-hmm. a little bit more. So I don't know that my problem with his performance is with the performance as much as like just something that was left on the cutting room floor somewhere. But everything he does great at. And you know, I'm so proud of my boy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I a little more time in that, when you drink the juice that makes you bad, is it flipping a switch or do we have a little bit more of an internal discourse?
Do you think
first?
That's where Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom got juice that makes you bad? Probably.
Yep, obviously. Probably.
Yeah, I think I'm a 5. I think this is, like I said, this is like we saw him become a man, you know, grizzled beard pending potentially. But sure. The scene where he, for better or for worse, becomes the, you know, future genocidal leader he's going to be, it's so powerful. Like, I'm not going to go as far as to make the jokey, like, well, I get it. Well, they all started following him. But like that power and that that it's so intensely good and unfortunately attractive, which is going to lead into the next ratings for me. Yeah, I think it's a stellar performance. I think it's maybe his best performance since Call Me By Your Name, and he's had a lot of good performances since then. I don't know. Anytime I see him succeed on screen, I'm so glad I hitched my wagon to this particular Hollywood art throb.
For sure.
So, Phil, when it comes to attractiveness, and we can get a little loosey-goosey here. In the past, we've kind of let the character influence it a tiny bit. It can be, obviously, the hair as it's its own category, but that factors in as well. But attractiveness can be, you can define it however you want it to. So how many peaches / sandworms are you going to give Timmy / Paul's attractiveness in Dune Part 2?
Oh, I mean, 5 peaches. I mean, the guy looks beautiful in this movie. I mean, there is just sort of, I mean, truth be told, everyone looks pretty beautiful in this movie. Everyone is sort of like sun-kissed and sand swept, and everyone just looks like they're in a perfume ad or something like that. So it's, you know, he's a very attractive man. He's got this square jaw and these beautiful eyes, and like, yeah, you understand why, you know, everyone's so obsessed with the guy. It's hard not to, and these beautiful locks of hair. I mean, hard not to, I mean, what's not to love?
Agree. Emily, how about you? How many sandworms are we given Timmy / Paul?
You know, in the last 5 years or so, I've discovered just how attracted I am to men.
And it's all come up to this moment. This is it.
It's been a fun journey being like this part of my brain that I kept locked away for much of my life, just like that door opening and bursting open. Like every time I do anything, it's like a fun lesson. And like, I might just learn a new thing about myself today. And what happened when I saw Dune Part 2 was I learned I like absolute bald psychopaths and like guys who are like, kind of like, have like, just like a, like kind of a Zen, like creepy thing. Like, you know, where they're just like, you know, like there's a kindness and a sensitivity to them. And then they become a genocidal maniac. I'm like, I can leave that. But if the guy just came up to me and was like, I'm going to stab you in the eye, I'd be like, ooh, okay. But you know what?
Oh my God.
If we're not just talking who Emily's attracted to, because I'm attracted to homicidal maniacs, but also Josh Brolin. He's hot in this movie.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll go 5 sandworms. Just objectively, he's a very beautiful person. And he looks very beautiful here.
Absolutely.
And when he's evil, I like him more. Let's think about that.
Hey, I'm in agreement. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a character or an actor in this movie who like isn't 5 out of 5 peaches hot. Yeah, I'm a 5.2, but like I host this podcast, so like obviously I'm in the bag for him. The one point I want to make before we jump to hair, which I think is a slightly more interesting discussion than the attractiveness. and it might just be because I'm watching Feud Capote versus the Swans right now, and I'm grappling with, and maybe it's been happening for a while and I just noticed it, but I'm grappling with actors and actresses who get veneers, and it just changes the way that their mouth looks. And every time we see Timmy's perfectly imperfect teeth, I just pray to the God that I don't believe in that he never caps those beautiful, beautiful teeth.
There was a shot.
I doubt he will.
In this film where we were looking at Anya Taylor-Joy's mouth and we were looking down like an angle we don't normally see, and her, the bottom half of her mouth is just a mess. And I was like, don't touch it. Don't touch it. Leave
it's
it.
It's a mess.
Don't. Leave it. No, please. I
also, I mean, talk about this. Zendaya has the little front tooth that's a little bit askew. It's like, just don't fuck
don't,
with that stuff.
Please don't. I'm not going to name names, but there's an actress in Feud who I adore. And I'm like, I hope this is for the character. I just, it's driving me insane. All right, well, let's move on to Hair, and I'm really excited to dig into this one because I've got some things to say, but we're not going to start with me. We're going to start with Phil. Phil, where do you fall?
I think I hit it already. I already said his hair was great, so I'm at 5 on his hair.
Phil's at 5. Emily, are you lining up with 5?
I just feel like I have to be the iconoclast here. You know what though? I didn't particularly notice his hair. It's good hair. When I think about Chalamet, I don't really think about his hair. It's not like the thing that draws me to him.
Fascinating.
Now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, that is pretty distinctive hair for like a star. But like I find his overall demeanor is like what draws me to him. Just like the thing where he's kind of like, there's a interesting, kind of reserved fainess to him that I think is wonderful. And particularly when it's used well. And I guess his hair is part of that. Anyway, I'm going to give it a 5 sandworms because I don't actually have an opinion, and it feels safe to just give it a high score.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I mean, you've established here that like bald Austin Butler is like your number one of the bullet here. So like,
I don't think
hair
that hair is important in an attractive person, because bald Austin Butler.
Sure. All right. So I got to talk about the hair for a second, because I've obviously put my stake in the ground. This is what I podcast for. So I'm gonna give it a 4. And I feel like even though that's like a very solid like rating, like an 80% is very good, I feel like I have to explain it. And here's why. And I think it's thematically, I think it makes sense. I think the reasoning behind why I have to give it a lower score is actually like a 5 out of 5. So before he becomes, future jihadist, the hair is flowing, it's longer, it's windswept, he's in the desert. As soon as the big speech happens, all of a sudden the hair gets tighter to the skull and a little less wavy flowy. And I'm very pro wavy flowy Timmy hair. So that's where I have to knock off one peach and or sandworm is at the end, I don't like when it gets a little bit more, it's not like full helmet head, but it just doesn't kind of fall on the face as much. And I like full ladybird head in a book, cigarette in a mouth, just like covered the face. You know, I'm a child, my teen years were in the mid to late aughts, so like the skater boy Vans aesthetic is like what I'm all about. So anytime the hair is just like in the face doing that, I'm all in. So that's why I'm at a 4, but I want to acknowledge that like the hair, it's Timothy Chalamet's hair, much like Sex and Pizza, even when it's bad, it's good. So like we're all good.
There you go. Amazing.
Well, that I believe about does it for our 24th episode of Chasing Chalamet. Phil and Emily, thank you guys so much for being here. This has been an incredible discussion. I'm so glad to have you guys here on the pod. Is there anything you'd like to promote, anything that you'd like to point people to who are listening, presences on the internet, etc.?
Emily, do you want to start?
Can I just say that I saw this movie on International Women's Day, and what a great way to celebrate International Women's Day than a movie about women being millennia old witch priestesses manipulating all of space and time. Jesus. How I want to plug myself.
Okay. We have a podcast. Emily and I have a podcast called Podcast Like It's 1992, where we talk about the films of 1992.
For a little while longer.
We talk about some music.
for a little while longer. We will be changing up very soon. But currently we have lots of great episodes. My cousin Vinny is coming up with Katie Rich. We've got Karina Longworth coming on for The Player. And I do a Patreon as well, where I talk about double features. I talk about two movies or songs or TV episodes. I will also only be doing that a little bit longer until we switch that up soon. But people can listen to us at Podcast Like It's on various things. And our Patreon is www.patreon.com/podcastlikeits. So sign up.
And there's a whole previous series that I was occasionally guested on about the films of 1999. It's...
And by occasionally, she means
a lot. It's very like, it's a good show. She said of the show she co-hosts.
You're just practicing for when you write on the future legacy sequel season only, and you have to talk about how good
It is. It's gonna be great. Emily is wonderful, as everyone knows. She's one of our finest minds on media. And I am honored to be doing the podcast with her, and like that.
Phil, where can people find you on the socials if they want to?
If they want to, they can follow me at PM Iskov, all one word, on Twitter or whatever the hell people are calling it, and on Threads and on Letterboxd and on
Blue Sky,
mostly Blue Sky. Yeah. They can also follow our podcast at Podcast Like It's on all of those various mediums as well. What about you, Emily? Where can people find you?
I'm Emily St. Jams on all social media platforms. I primarily hang out on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Please follow me there. Tweet unless I'm promoting something, but I do occasionally check out the X.com platform. I'm also on Threads, Instagram, all the things. You can, of course, listen to podcasts like It's 1992. You can listen to my old podcast, Arden, which is still going, but I'm no longer involved. But it's like a scripted true crime thing with lesbians. I'm writing on the third season of the TV show Yellow Jackets. I had nothing to do with the first two seasons, but they're very good and you should watch them so that you can be ready for the season I did have something to do with. So you can like send me messages on social media platforms and be like, that was nice, Emily. Good work.
And from what I'm hearing, season three is going to be crazy.
It's going to be good. It's going to be good. And it's I'm very proud and excited and happy with everything that is happening on that show right now. And I have a book coming out in September about the show Lost. It's called Back to the Island. And I have a novel coming out in 2025. And you can find a whole bunch of other, just fucking Google me. That's how you find out what I'm up to.
Google Emily St. James.
Yeah.
And
yeah, just sign up for a Google alert for Emily St. James and you'll be good.
I'm going to see what happens why did Emily St. James change her name? Let's find out what the answer is.
Why do you think that was, Emily?
I haven't changed it professionally yet because what a pain. Is Emily still with James? Are James and Emily Blunt related? Well, now we're just getting off topic. I changed it because I didn't want to have my old last name because I didn't want associated with certain people. But also, if I don't change my name every few years, I die. So,
which sounds like a Bene Gesserit edict in my brain.
100%.
Well, in my heart, Emily, you're just going to be Reverend Mother, and Phil, you can be Reverend Mother too.
I appreciate it. It's okay to give you guys both the moniker.
Phil, I, as a Bene Gesserit member, am like, you get to be the one guy in the Bene Gesserit.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you. Do I get to wear those cool outfits?
No, you have to you have to serve us punch. After every meeting.
Fair enough.
Well, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at the Dane McDonald. I'm on Letterboxd as well. Letterboxd, Twitter, Instagram, kind of the ones I'm most active on if you'd want to follow me. The show is on Twitter and Instagram as well. On Twitter, we are Chalamet Chasing. And on Instagram, we are Chasing Chalamet. If you're listening to the show and you're enjoying it, please consider giving us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening. And also please consider sharing it with your friends and your family and your loved ones. Chasing Chalamet is written, hosted, and produced by me, Dane McDonald. The show is also produced and edited by Will Bybee. Our theme music is by Jacob Horn. You can hear more from him and his band, the Jacob Horn Trio, on Spotify, Apple Music, and Bandcamp. Our cover art, as always, designed by Jessica Deal. You can find more of her work at jessicadeal.com. Deal is spelled D-E-A-H-L. And until next time, later.